Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
It's Sunday the 4th of February. Dry Jan has finished for many. I bet there was some drinking done on Thursday night around the bars and towns in the UK, and certainly around the world as well, where they participate. I think I'm about a year and a month in, so I've finally knocked it on the head for good. But I think it's a good thing to do for people, to give their livers a rest, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been off Coca-Cola for 4 months now.
Your liver liver and stomach feeling better for that?
I hope so. Should be getting smaller, I hope so. What month did I give up? October, November, December, and now January. Yeah, 4 months.
I've given up Coke Zero as well this last few weeks as well, because that's got a lot of nasty, like I was watching that, I think I sent you the video on all these things that, like, all these natural or non-natural sugars, you know, these aspartames and things like that, these sweeteners including them, and like some of the stuff you read and see, it's just not a nice process how it's made, and it's really not good for your body. It kind of tricks your body into like almost like a sugar spike, like an insulin spike. And I just genuinely think that it's not the greatest drink. So I've knocked that on the head. Feel a bit better for that in terms of sugar rushes, etc. But coffee is the only really thing now that I have caffeine in my diet that I really should knock it on there. So some days I'm drinking 3-4 cups, and yeah, I think decaf is the way forward on that one. But again, some people say that it's not the nicest of processes. But anyway, let's have a look at the news. I mean, the big news headline in the UK this week was that disposable vapes are to be banned for children's health. Vape stocks took a hammering at the start of the week with some recovery. We will obviously hear from Callum Summerton, CEO of Chilbrands, later on in this episode. So, listen out for that. But what are your thoughts on it? I mean, it's a bit sketchy, isn't it, really, the details around it? There's not much detail in there, is there?
So it seems to be just like a PR scam anyway. It's crazy. I mean, I don't understand why you would put all the PR out and not actually firm it up with the details. I mean, the normal situation in these situations is that, you know, they do give the details very shortly after, even if they're not like finalized, but a lot of them. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, seems to me to be like there's not a lot of logic and sense gone into it. It would surely have been better to put taxation on these things and also, you know, only sell them through certain scenarios like tobacco counters or whatever, so that you're not buying them off your hairdresser and, you know, the corner shop and all the rest of it, unless they sell tobacco. Yeah,
it may not come into fruition. I mean, we don't forget we've potentially got the election looming, or that'll happen this year. So it might be that he leaves Downing Street sooner rather than later, and that, you know, maybe it won't be pushed through. His tobacco, plus he's also, it was talking about imposing the tobacco laws as well, where he was obviously going to raise the ages, and so that potentially people who were born as it after 2005 would never ever be able to buy tobacco products in their life, just like Australia and New Zealand, I believe, introduced a similar sort of steps to stopping people smoking. So maybe it'll never happen anyway.
Yeah, I think probability wise, obviously we'll hear from Callum, but probability wise, I think it's 50-50 if it actually comes in. And even if it does, I think we're talking a minimum of 12 months and probably more likely, you know, towards the end of 2025, if it comes in whatever shape it comes in. So the reaction that we've had in terms of the chill share price anyway has been a bit strange, to be honest. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But there you go. Such is life.
Yeah. There's some more on the news. I don't know if you saw it. Pretty grisly. The suspect in an alkali attack in South London was convicted of a sex offence in 2018 and was later granted asylum after applying three times. They're looking for Abdul Shakur Azedi, 35, who was last seen in North London on Wednesday evening, where a mother and a 3-year-old daughter were hurt by the corrosive substance, could have suffered life-changing injuries on the attack. Police have warned people not to approach Azedi and to instead call 999. So that looked pretty grim. There was a lot of videos showing it effectively unfolding on X. And let's hope this guy, I mean, there's a picture of him, and he was pictured in a Tesco after some 70 minutes after the attack. And his face, I don't know if you've seen it, his eye is like, it's almost like his eye's been removed. So it looks like he's been injured in by whatever this caustic, you know, alkali substance has been that he's used to douse on this poor woman and a child. I mean, it's a pretty horrific thing. Obviously, they're coming under a lot of scrutiny now, saying that he's effectively an asylum seeker who was finally granted asylum in 2018, but he's also been known to the authorities. So that looks pretty grim this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite obvious he's mentally unstable by the looks of things. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing those things. So, yeah, not good at all. But moving away from that, let's talk about what's happening in Africa.
So let's move on to this week's first guest. We're joined by Charles Bray and Simon Rollison from Aterion. Welcome back, gents. Nice to see you both.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Thank you.
How's things going? I know you're out in Botswana at the moment. How's things been going there after the news of the acquisition of the licenses?
Yeah, no, it's good. It's the first time that we've had an opportunity to come down, meet our new local partner down here. We've had a couple of meetings with government authorities just to introduce the company, outline what we're trying to do, what we've done in the past in other jurisdictions like Rwanda and Morocco. And it's just sort of sitting down and we're going to go meet some contractors this afternoon, and then put together a work program of what we want to try and achieve over the next 12 months up on the Kalahari Copper Belt, where we have the one license, and then also around the Sewer Pan area, where we believe there's some good opportunity and potential for lithium brine.
Let's have a quick look, Simon, obviously on the recent news where you put out positive findings from the recent sampling on the Azrock project in Morocco, which I believe now covers some nearly 100 square kilometres following new licence awards. You had highlights including significant results, 4.01% copper and 26.9 grams per tonne of silver from sedimentary hosted copper targets. Continued copper mineralisation has also identified in Adouadouan sediments, not an easy one to say, along with mineralised quartz veins and breccia zones on the new licences, some of which contain gold as a byproduct. So, do you want to just talk us through that news and you know, how you sort of came to the positive findings?
Yeah, so with Azra, we had done a little bit of prospecting earlier on in the year. This is 2023. And we had identified a number of styles of mineralization occurring on the project, which is quite interesting. So we have the sedimentary hosted copper potential where we took some samples and we identified some reasonable sort of copper values coming out of that. We had 1.2%. out of one sample and previously 1.5% copper. But, you know, we were really looking to explore the two new permits that we acquired midway through last year, which we call the Northern Azra permits. So the field team got out there to do some reconnaissance and we identified a series of old abandoned historical workings. And these are just basic pits that went down to a maximum of about 7 meters, targeting a quartz vein along a sort of north trending structure. So we've been in there, sort of mapped it out, and we can see some good continuity along one structure. We took some samples where we reported 1.2 and 1.7% copper. But interestingly, what we found was that there's also gold associated with this particular area of the mineralization. So we had like 0.5 gram of gold reporting from there. So that in itself is highly encouraging as a potential byproduct. The structures look to be quite strong and continuous. You know, we took some samples separated by about 2 kilometers along the same structure. And we do see when we're out in the field parallel structures. So going forwards, there's a lot of sort of upside opportunity within those new permits. And then the sampling also reinforced what we've seen previously, where across the central part of the project, we have a northeast trending fault zone that has a quartz carbonate breccia that hosts significant copper. So previously we'd had up to, I think it was what, 3.8% copper with 23 grams per ton of silver. So it's looking very encouraging. And we have some clearly defined targets now that we, you know, we can really focus our efforts in on. Because as you say, you know, it's a big area. It's nearly 100 square kilometers. But now we're able to telescope into selected areas to get some detail onto the project.
Yeah. And it also comes off the back of the other recent sampling results at the Tatar project, which is located some 30 kilometers south of Azra. You saw grades up to about 7% copper, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So very similar rocks. It's these Dudu formation or Adudian Cambrian age sediments that host the mineralization. And it's similar to what the Managem group has at the Desert Development Project, which is about 50 kilometers away from us. Now, they've got a provisional resource, I think it's about 57 million tons at just over 1% copper. Some silver there as well, about, I think it's about 15 grams per ton silver, if memory serves me. So yeah, we see similar sort of parables on Azra as we do in Tarta with respect to the sedimentary copper target. But what we're finding at Azra is that we also have two other styles of mineralization that we can focus in on as well. So it's a very exciting opportunity.
Do you think that, you mentioned a previous strike length of over 18 kilometers. Do you think that this is really building up to be a copper district?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's multiple currents of copper throughout the Western Anti-Atlas, and we have the Azra project. We've got Tarta. Tarta's the one where we've identified so far copper mineralization to occur along 18 kilometers of the strike. We still have about 20, 25 kilometers unexplored that we still need to test, but we're sort of optimistic that we're going to still see copper mineralization occurring along these features. And then, you know, as part of the new permits that were awarded last year, we have the West Tazalak and we have Akka, which also are sedimentary hosted copper targets. So it's a great destination for this style of mineralization.
Very good, Simon. Let me just bring you back to Botswana, because we understand you were originally born in Botswana. Is that right?
No. I wasn't born there. I was born in Ghana. I lived here for 20 years. Yeah. I lived here for about 20 years when I was a youngster, so I was at primary school here and ended up working here in my early years, so sort of covered a lot of the country, know a lot of the people here, so it's familiar territory.
Okay, very good. So from the point of view of understanding the culture and what's going on, that's obviously going to be a big positive in terms of things going on.
Well, completely, because, you know, I haven't actually been back here for about 25 years. So the city itself, Gaborone, has completely changed and pretty unrecognizable, to be honest, but the culture, the mentality, the locations of where you want to be looking for particular elements, that remains the same. And it's just having a clear sort of understanding of how the culture works, as you say, and how we can take that forwards.
Yeah, so just tell us a little bit about on the ground in Botswana.
Okay, so if we're focusing on the Kalahari Copper Belt, it's a very similar style of mineralization to what we see up in Morocco. But the difference is, of course, is that Morocco, we see it on the surface. So In Botswana, you just got to apply different techniques and processes to your exploration than you would in Morocco. But, you know, our new local partner, who's a geologist here, he's familiar with the Kalahari Copper Belt. And I think taking him up to Morocco would be a complete eye-opener for him, because he'd be able to see that mineralization or the structure sitting on the surface. And, you know, to take that knowledge back to the exploration efforts in Botswana. I mean, that was really the rationale behind the Botswana acquisition, was that the metals and the style of mineralization are already what we are looking for in Morocco. So we're building up that knowledge already. So it's just an add-on. It's nothing new.
And you were talking about a sale that has occurred in the Kalahari Copper Belt. What was that all about?
Yeah, it was announced last year. There was a company, Kumansal, I think it was, I can never pronounce it properly. Anyway, they had a deposit there which was running, I think, about 90 million tons, and they sold that in a couple of satellite deposits to a Chinese entity for $2 billion. Now, if we look at the analogies that we see in Morocco with Tazert and also with Tarta, where, you know, Tazert has a 57 million ton resource, there's only one deposit, I think, in the copper belt in Botswana that's bigger than that. So it sort of gives you a sense of the scale and the opportunity that we see. You know, these deposits aren't going to be porphyry deposits where you're hundreds of millions of tons or billions, but, you know, 57 million tons for a sedimentary hosted is very respectable.
Just to provide a little bit of detail, it was $1.88 billion, and it was to the Chinese company MMG. So your listeners can check it out.
Yeah, so, but I think the important aspect is really the potential scale of the opportunities in Morocco really are big, you know, and can be worth a huge amount of money. So as we move forward, yeah, I'm sure there's going to be some interest in these assets. And as you said, you're going to be drilling and putting a few holes in there to see what the situation is.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, we are very confident in what we have in Morocco.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so maybe moving back just to Morocco, in terms of the overall in Morocco, I mean, I think Charles has said to me the last time that Tarta is really the main target that you have in Morocco. But what else do you envisage happening in Morocco? Because you have a lot of licenses there. I think it was 18 or 19 licenses. So how do you see that moving forward in 2024?
Well, it's 17 projects and it's about 60 permits in total. So yeah, obviously we as a small company can't cover everything. So we're focusing in on what we consider to be the key projects. Tata is obviously one, Azra, and then we have another project called Agdas. Agdas is different from Tata and Azra in the fact that it's not sedimentary hosted play. It's more of a structurally controlled hydrothermal copper silver target. And what we're looking to do there is see if we can get some scout drilling underway in the near future so we can just test the model. You know, we have some really good grades coming out of there. We've narrowed down that license to five or six sort of key prospects within the license. I think that has an exciting future ahead of it as well. And the other key project would be what we call the Gibelet project, which just sits outside of Marrakesh. There again, we've got a significant number of veins that are continuous up to 3 kilometers in length, hosting copper and silver. The plan for that one would be just to get some more mapping in, understand the structures, the density of the veins, and start channeling across them to understand the potential across the zones, which in places can be up to 10 meters wide. And, you know, it's a very accessible area, so getting some drilling done would be quite easy as well.
That one is, does it have the potential then, based on what you get, is it, are we talking sort of VMS type copper project in terms of that, or not quite, but similar in terms of the ability to get the copper and the silver out of the ground pretty quickly in terms of that, so you're not following a system, or am I right, or is that not necessarily the case?
No, it's not a VMS as such. It's confined to a clear structural pattern that we've identified through the geophysics and mapping. And along these structures, you've had later stage mafic dikes intruding, which have brought up the sort of mineralized fluid. That mineralized fluid has precipitated out along these structures, but also has percolated into some surrounding beds of conglomerate where we see the copper mineralization. So going forwards, I think once we get some drill holes into it and we understand the continuity of the grade below the surface, prove up the two sort of styles of mineralization within the sort of subvertical structures and also within the sort of secondary environment where it's percolated out into these shallow dipping conglomeratic beds, then we'll be able to put together a nice program going forwards based on that data.
Okay. I mean, before Rwanda came about, as in the ability to have the joint venture with Rio Tinto and the lithium, Aterion really was aiming to be a copper producer or a copper explorer, I should say, in Morocco. Would that be fair to say?
I'd say we were aiming to be a critical metals explorer across Africa. And so the Moroccan transaction with Elemental Altus fit in very nicely with that, given the number of projects. And as we were making the move to the LSE, the standard segment, it was necessary to have a broader portfolio of projects. It just so happened that that acquisition coincided with our lithium discoveries in Rwanda. So that's where we got a bit, don't want to say distracted, because it's our job to be doing this exploration work. So we had to focus on Rwanda for a bit more than we had originally anticipated. But
yeah, and I think that was the point I'm making, is from the point of view of when you first came to market, Morocco was there, Rwanda was coming on board, but originally when you set Aterion up, yes, it was critical metals across Africa, but the main licenses and plays were in Morocco. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, we had acquired those main licenses in Morocco for the purpose of the listing. And we had anticipated they were going to be the primary value generator going forward. But it didn't take very long before Simon and his contacts at Rio Tinto determined that there was much more potential in Rwanda.
Yeah, and the reason why I say that, both Simon and Charles, is that, you know, people have looked at Aterion and valued Aterion maybe on Rwanda and the fact that the lithium's there and that we're going to have some trading within Rwanda as well in terms of the different resources available. But actually, a huge play in Aterion is what is in Morocco. So
absolutely,
that's the point I'm really trying to make. And again, what do you think are the main drivers that are going to happen going forward? I mean, from both of you.
Yeah. My quick couple cents is one on the trading side in Rwanda. I think that's going to be value generative. It's a few weeks late. I put my hand up and say that's the case. But as well, I think that strategically, we have an opportunity to partner with some key players and do some exploration for an absolutely critical metal in this whole energy transition, and that's copper. And I think that a joint venture and or greater exploration efforts in Morocco will add a tremendous amount of value to the company.
Yeah, because the work that we've been doing so far in Morocco has generated some superb results. ASRA with the last release, the 4% with 20 grams per ton of silver is very good. And the more work we do, the more excited we are with these projects. They just keep growing in potential. The grades are there, they're strong. We're starting to see continuity along structures. Yeah, these are all the right indicators for good value in the future.
Yeah, the project that you said is sort of 50 kilometers away from Kata and ASRA. What sort of size was that you were saying that they have contained copper?
That's the Tzert development project operated by Managem. So that's roughly 57 million tons at just over 1% copper. And I think it's around about 12 grams per ton silver.
Okay. So 57 million tons is a fair amount in terms of the size of a copper.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great project. And, when we talk about the Agdez project, which we described just briefly earlier on, we have another project nearby, which is called Burskur, and that's also a managing project. And that's got 50 million tons at 1% copper. So in the areas where we're operating, we've got demonstrable sort of success and projects of good size. So, the location of where we are in Morocco is excellent. The sedimentary copper potential in the Western Anti-Atlas, we're demonstrating that at ASRA and Tata. Agdez with the copper, silver, and the structures, very similar to what you'd see at Burskur. Yeah.
When you talk about a project of 50 million tons of contained copper, is that 50 million tons of contained copper or 50 right. million tons of resource that's, without 1%?
That's the resource. It's 50, well, Tzert is 57 million tons at just over 1% copper. So that's the mineral resource, not the contained.
So that'll give you, take 1% of that, you're looking at about 570,000 tons of copper. Is that how you would do the down conversion on that?
As a back of the envelope. Yeah, exactly. But then you'll see they'll be factoring in their recovery levels.
Sure. But half a million tons of contained copper over a, say, 15 to 20 year project is quite a significant amount of copper per annum. And yeah. You're talking about 20,000 tons a year minimum. And this is a big project. It's not a small thing. I think that's what I'm trying to point out to people, is that if you find anything of this scale, this is going to be, a game changer, really. I mean, that's going to be worth a significant amount of money.
Well, that's the sort of target, exploration target that we're setting ourselves, is to find comparables to these known occurrences. We've got similar styles of geology and mineralization. We've got the scale and the land. So yeah, that's what we're setting our goal on.
Very good. Very good. So Charles, moving to Rwanda, as we skip and hop across the continent of Africa, tell us what's happening with Rio and what has happened, since the last time we spoke.
Yeah, we gave an update not too long ago, and what we tried to make sure the market was aware of was that we've advanced and fairly, I'd say pretty much completed a lot of the groundwork on the license area. We're now looking to get the drilling started, and so that takes a lot. There's some logistical issues that need to be resolved in terms of getting the drill rigs on site, but those are being worked on as well. You may have seen recently Rio Tinto announced that they had established a partnership with MOU with the Rwandan government in terms of some exploration efforts. We're very happy to see that. It's rare when Rio Tinto says anything to the media until after the fact, generally. But what I think this indicates, and this is just a personal opinion, is that this area is a potentially new lithium province, that they're committed to doing significant exploration work with the government to establish whether that's the case or not. So while they're busy working on that, we're busy working away ourselves in Rwanda. We're not just a one-trick pony there. And so we hope soon to be announcing to the market some additional activity in Rwanda. So we're very, very busy is what I'm trying to say.
It sounds it. And I mean, I suppose my question, and I suppose investors' questions would be right now, is how are you going to focus the attention? Because you have an awful lot. You've got Botswana, you've got Rwanda, yeah. you've got Morocco. So how are we going to focus on the things that we can move up the scale quickly, like, as opposed to just a blanket, we're doing all these things?
Yeah, I think it's about having the right people in the right places. And we just shortly going to make an announcement about a new hire, or at least we plan to make an announcement shortly about a new hire. It's still not done, but that will be critical to making sure we can progress things in both Morocco and then an additional, I shouldn't say an announcement, I should say we have the right sort of leadership here in Botswana as well. So it's about getting the right people involved, also making sure we keep the company lean and mean so that we can hire in when we need to do exploration work, and then utilizing the resources we have. So again, getting back to the trading, which is a bit late, we have the right people there. And I'm very pleased that we've been progressing that, and we plan to be making announcements about that over the course of the next couple of weeks. So there's a lot going on as well. We're trying to manage and meet with people at the mining in Daba in Cape Town. And we encourage anyone who might listen to this who's in town to stop by our booth there.
Anything to add, Sam?
Look, I mean, it's absolutely right. And then from an operational point of view, if we look at Rwanda, we can almost sort of effectively say that Rio's taken care of the exploration spend that needs to be done on it, the HCK project. You know, we're still looking for other opportunities, but that's in the future. So we can concentrate a lot of our exploration efforts on Morocco and building up those projects and the project pipeline that we've established down there. The new acquisition in Botswana is more early stage. So that's what we're down here discussing at the moment, is setting up the 12-month program. So that'll be a lot of data acquisition, reprocessing of data that's available. And the field work will be sort of getting out orientation, start a soil sampling program over certain areas, build up a database of existing wells and knowledge around the pans for the lithium brine opportunity. So there's a lot of work to be done on those elements in Botswana, but it's not particularly costly for the company, which is the main thing, and we can get a lot of information out of it. We just have to do the exploration smart, not waste money.
To recap, what we're looking at here is a company that has a world-class joint venture in Rwanda with Rio Tinto, and the potential of that I don't want to undermine, but I think it is vast, a word used regardless of the current lithium price. I think that the reality is we're still going to need a lot of lithium going forward. There isn't going to be enough of it. There is the potential to have a world-class lithium deposit there in Rwanda, as me and Phil saw when we went over there. You have Morocco, which is effectively looks like it's full of copper and silver targets, even looking at just the four projects that you mentioned with Tata, Azra, Adgas, excuse my pronunciation, and Jubilee, I think it was that you said, all with good potential. And then now you're moving into Botswana as well in terms of the project that we saw the RNS for. So, I mean, if all those come good over this period of time, then you basically become Rio Tinto, no?
We very much would. Yes, I'll leave it at that.
No, but you would be a huge company if all of these things come to fruition.
If all of them come to fruition, absolutely. The reality is that not all of them will come to fruition. However, I think we have a great portfolio. I think it's better than most companies. I think we're dramatically undervalued. I think the market maybe does perceive that, maybe doesn't care. But I do fundamentally believe that, and when I say market, what I should have said was the listed shareholding market. What I think what we're seeing now is that the market in general, the broader market, so the market participants like the mining companies, the majors recognize the value. And so we're really working hard to translate that recognition into real hard cash to, for the benefit of our shareholders.
Yeah, I mean, I can see. I mean, I think a real ignition of your valuation criteria would be some sort of deal in Morocco on one of these projects. I think this would really cement your position. You would have a joint venture in Rwanda, you would have potential joint venture in Morocco, and obviously you then the workings are in Botswana at an early stage. But those things would really, I think, cement the position of Aterian, and on top of that, the trading would obviously help you cover a lot of the costs of Aterian going forward. So yeah, I think you're in a great position. I think you still need a couple of pieces in that jigsaw, but once those pieces are there, I think people will then see the value and jump on board.
On that note, we'll say Simon Rollison, Charles Bray of Aterian, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And on to our second guest this week, we're joined by Callum Somerton, CEO of Chill Brands. Welcome back, Callum.
Hi guys, good to see you.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I bet you've had a bit of a frustrating week, haven't you? Obviously, we heard the inevitable news that disposable vapes are to be banned for children's health. Just take us through your week, really, Callum, since the announcement was made sort of late on Sunday of last week.
Yeah, so obviously when I last came together with you guys on Monday to kind of give an overview of exactly what was going on, to be totally honest, it's been pretty much business as usual for us this week. Not much change. You know, the reusable device was a track that we were already on, already sort of progressing down regardless. So the news from the government just kind of pushes up our timeline a little bit. But all in all, yeah, very much business as usual, continuing to make sales, continuing to, you know, work on additional marketing campaigns. You know, it was a bit of a seismic shock at the start of the week, and now here we are and the sky's not falling in. So yeah, business as usual.
So I mean, obviously you must have known that this moment potentially would come, and obviously we've seen the video that you posted on X where you had you showed the refillable device, which I think you were looking at or had been developed for quite a few months. But how did it feel when the news came and you'd already kind of preempted that this potential ban that's going to be coming to place?
I think things are always better when you know exactly what's coming down the track and you can then, you know, play the field ahead and actually make decisions. It's uncertainty that is always difficult in business. With that being said, you know, we still don't have total certainty from the government on what counts as a disposable. I think it'll obviously be frustrating if it comes to pass that our 3000 puff device is not included. And we've been through sort of this period of instability. But yeah, I mean, as I say, the reason that we came to market with a, I guess, semi-disposable product is because that's simply where consumer preference still is. You know, as time goes on and also as regulations come to pass, people will move towards, the whole market will move towards reusable pod-based or otherwise devices. So, you know, obviously feels good for us to be in control of the situation and moving in the right direction. You know, as I say, this is not a cliff edge for us. It's just another reason to galvanize around our new concept.
Yeah. Do you feel a bit unfair that they're targeting all disposable vapes, despite, you know, basically, obviously, there's no mention about nicotine free, which is that one of the things that's the problem with children vaping? Obviously, it's illegal anyway to sell vapes to anyone under the age of 18. But does it seem unfair that it's nicotine which is the problem here and they're targeting all disposable vapes, whether they be nicotine-free, CBD, or, you know, that sort of thing? Do you want to just give a sort of background on why they're targeting all disposable vapes?
Yeah, I think in vaping, there are two core issues, or at least two primary issues that the industry needs to face down. The first one is environmental issues in terms of disposables. You've got lithium ion batteries. Obviously, you've got these units being sold en masse. And actually, I totally agree that that is an issue and it needs to be addressed. I think I've said on other kind of podcasts and in other media that actually a very, very large percentage of vapes are actually very widely recyclable. It's just changing consumer behavior. It's getting, you know, recycling disposal units into stores, making it really, really simple for people to do it. And then you've got to let them actually crack on with it. You know, that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And the same is true with, you can give a customer a recycling bin, but you can't make them recycle. And, you know, that's a big issue that the industry needs to face down. But obviously, you know, anything we can do to lessen the burden on the environment of you know, thousands, millions of lithium ion batteries coming into circulation, the better. So in that regard, I do think that this shift in the market to disposables would be good. The other issue, as you say, is children. And this is where the government's really sort of hung their hat. They've been very keen to point out, look, too many children are vaping. What they describe as an epidemic, I think, is arguably not that. You know, we've seen over the last several years, I won't kind of give the exact stats, but close to them, of teenagers vaping, I guess you've seen a reduction of 2% in them smoking and an increase of 3% in them vaping. Those numbers kind of cancel each other out. You know, everybody knows this. Kids are always going to find a way to lay their hands on something that they probably shouldn't. Doesn't mean we should facilitate that. The industry's made a rod for its own back in some quarters by adding, you know, stupid flavors, stupid designs. But I do think the government is missing a trick by saying, hey, this is going to save our kids as a policy, because what's actually going to happen is it's going to drive it underground.
Yeah.
It's going to go into the black market and they're not going to be able to control it. So it's...
they're obviously taking it very seriously. I've seen reports on there that they're employing sniffer dogs to go into schools to sniff out the scents and obviously, you know, then weed out anyone who is going off to the toilets or wherever they're doing it around the school grounds. I mean, it seems quite a sort of heavy tactic to take, doesn't it, to eliminate this?
Great use of public funds. You know, great way to deploy tax money. No, it's not very effective, really. Vape sniffer dogs and all the other measures that they kind of put into place, you know, give them great PR splashes and good, you know, good news for the government, I suppose. It's almost a populist policy that's not very popular. But the challenge really for them is that it doesn't actually, you know, it's not even a drop in the ocean. They don't fund trading standards properly. That's the big issue. My background before Chill was in IP law. We were doing this for fashion companies, making sure that the likes of, you know, Gucci were properly equipped to make sure that counterfeits in the country were dealt with. Trading standards are working their asses off, and they can't even scratch the surface with the amount of counterfeit product in this country. So if they think sniffer dogs in schools is going to, you know, actually move the needle, they're wrong. Let's look at Australia as well. You know, they've come out with this vape ban. They've not paid attention to what New Zealand's done, which is reversed that and taken the tax revenue. And they're now spending much more time and money on stopping vapes coming into the country than they are stopping heroin coming into their country. So you know, I think it is very, very heavy-handed. I think that there is a degree of kind of moral panic around it, as I've said before. Yes, something needs to be done to stop kids vaping, but, you know, the same can be said of what are we going to do to stop kids drinking? What are we going to do to stop kids smoking? There's always going to be something, and prohibition throughout history has failed in pretty much every country it's been affected in.
Then the cynic in me does say that there has been a move, we know, from traditional cigarettes away from there to vapes. And I do wonder, because there is a lot more tax coming into the government from cigarettes than there ever would be for vapes. So I do wonder whether there's an element of, let's push them back onto cigarettes. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's a degree of that as well. You know, they've already got the tax code set up for cigarettes. You know, the skeptic in me would say that they obviously are, you know, trying to work out the best ways to tax this. But I think they're probably less organized and less capable than we actually think they are. And that merely they were looking for something to go out into the headlines with. But, you know, look at other countries that have done this. If they are pushing back towards, you know, getting people onto cigarettes or sort of removing the alternatives that have been the best harm reduction tools we've got, well, eventually those countries, those jurisdictions are going to change, the political climate will change, and somebody at some point in the future will come along and say, hold on, we don't want to be feeding people carcinogenic, tar-emitting, combustible tobacco anymore. And then, you know, what are they going to be faced with? Well, they're going to have to look back to vaping.
Yeah. I mean, I think we talked about this offline, didn't we? They've missed a trick by not imposing larger taxes on these, or, you know, increasing the price of vapes, just like they did with sugar tax, just like they've done with alcohol to try and price out. I mean, you'd price the kids out, right, if you added about £3 or £4 onto a single-use vape, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. You know, stick a few pounds on it. It takes it out of that pocket money spend category, which is something we were obviously describing when we first came to market with our first devices. You know, make it more expensive for children. And obviously, I think what we ought to do really is what the UK Vape Industry Association and other affiliated parties have suggested. That's coming before Parliament for discussion in February. And it's simply, look, let's do a retailer licensing scheme. Let's make sure these things are only sold by legitimate places, legitimate stores, not by kebab shops, not by hairdressers, but by places that, you know, are already on the hook for alcohol and tobacco to ID people. And if somebody comes through and sell a vape without a license, fine the hell out of them. That would make it very, very manageable. At that point, trading standards could probably get a good handle on the situation. So I think that's a much cleaner, much better solution. And put the tax on as well. You know, Lord knows the company, the country could do with some tax revenue. So I don't see any of that as sort of illogical.
So the question that I was trying to understand in my own mind is, why at this point in the process would a government splash something out like this? Because it doesn't seem to be very well thought through and make a lot of sense. Why do you think that they've done at this point?
I don't think that it's an enormous vote winner. That was perhaps where everybody's heads went for, you know, first. It's, you know, this is something that they're trying to milk some votes out of, get some good support behind. I think the reality is, from what we've heard, this is a real sort of passion project for the current Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. Whether you support him in other areas or not, this is a sort of an area where he is very emotive. You know, it's a decision that's been taken perhaps against the advice of public health professionals. It's a decision that sort of flies in the face of some of the commentary that's been put around this by, I mean, look at Action on Smoking and Health, ASH, in the UK. They recommended a completely different policy because they view the black market and other unintended consequences of a ban to be too dangerous. These are people who would probably, I think somebody said on public media this week, they would probably ban you from having a cup of tea if they could. But they are against a ban in this instance. So I think that's why the policies come out. They have to be seen to be doing something. You know, whether this is the right thing or not, at least it shows that the wheels are in motion. But in typical sort of governmental fashion, so far we've got a PR statement and not draft legislation, which shows that perhaps it's half-baked.
Yeah, that was the question I was going to ask. I mean, surely with this PR drive that they put out on Sunday night, Monday morning, where's the legislation? Where's the actual facts of what they're going to do? Because they've left us all guessing there.
Always takes time to come in any sort of big government policy shift. But I think the reality is they still aren't totally decided. You know, they've said we may use environmental law to drive this change. We may use tobacco laws or regulations to drive this change. The answer is that they probably don't know. They've sort of issued a statement, given a general direction, and they'll work it out as they go along. I would suggest that in an election year, that's pretty shaky ground because, you know, whenever that election comes, I wouldn't want to be the parliamentary scheduling clerk trying to get that onto the roster for sort of first and second readings before the Houses. So, I think that, look, it's a great PR move for them, maybe, right now. But what actually comes out could be quite different to what we've seen in the PR.
Yeah, and I mean, realistically speaking, this isn't going to happen in 2024, even if they get it through the House by the sounds of things, especially with a six-month period thereafter. So you're probably talking, realistically, the earliest possible scenario is this time next year. So from that point of view, the whole industry, including Jill Brands, will have changed, as in it will start to do this. What I don't understand is really why they did, I still said, miss the boat and didn't just tax the whole thing. And then you cannot have the hairdresser selling you a vape because, you know, they have to basically go through the whole process of paying the taxation on it and all the rest of it. And it's become a cash, you know, all the dodgy vapes that are out there become a cash in hand business, haven't they?
The comment I made on LBC earlier this week with Tom Swarbrick was ultimately, look, the companies, the businesses, the operators, if you can call them that, that are already selling vapes to children or dodgy vapes, don't give a toss what the law is. They already don't give a toss what the law is. So banning them is only going to drive those products out of the hands of legitimate retailers. It's going to drive a huge surge in black market sales, as we've seen with every product that gets banned. You know, this country has a very serious issue with duty-free, potentially counterfeit tobacco products, cigarettes. And so now we're doing that in a whole new environment and adding lithium-ion batteries into the mix. It's just not a great idea, full stop. But yeah, you're right on the tax. They have missed a trick. We're hearing now in the, you know, the March budget that, or the spring budget, I should say, that the sort of proposed tax cuts that they were hoping to bring out will now be less than they'd expected. You know, so this isn't going to be the vote winner that I think they're hoping it will be. What really would be a vote winner is something that sticks a load of cash into the national, you know, savings account and allows them to, you know, bring down people's heating bills or, you know, reduce the burden that's currently on the country's councils. So I don't really see the rationale, but I think it is one of those cases where you've had the media beating a drum against vapes for months and months and months, often misguided. I saw a tweet, by the way, this week from a journalist saying, has anybody got an 8 to 10 year old child and they're worried about their vaping? Please write to me. I need to include it in my article. If this were the issue that is being suggested it is, they wouldn't need to be making a public appeal for people to feature in their articles. People would be already there. So it is very much a just, look, reactionary, here's what the media is doing. Government needs to be seen to be doing something.
Yep, absolutely. So just give us, as a last thing, how you see Chill moving forward in all of this, and then let's take it from there.
Yeah, you know, as I say, this is a path we were already on in terms of moving to a reusable device. If anything, it sort of pushes our timeline up a little bit, but not all that much, on the basis that, as you say, you know, change is not coming quite yet. The government has stated, I think, on their media rounds on Monday that they were looking to implement from the start of 2025. They've got this 6-month moratorium period. You know, that's in terms of actually launching a new product, that's almost too long. You know, 18 months back, we weren't a vaping company. We are agile. We're ready to move. We're already focusing very hard on our new sort of product development and bringing the product to market. So all it's going to do is shift our positioning very, very slightly and give us another great opportunity to hammer home that, look, we are a UK brand. We are driving innovation in the market. We're providing something that is actually intended for adult users to help quit tobacco, to quit nicotine. And that's as simple as it is, really. If anything, all of this, you know, on the plus side, will drive the sort of cheap operators who are here to make quick money out of the market and into another area of the world. So, you know, as I say, business as usual, and, you know, really excited to be getting to grips with the new product and revealing it in due course.
Great. I mean, thanks for the discussion. And I think, because it's been a sudden moment of this, everybody sort of panicked a bit. I mean, I think from my perspective, the Chill share price was crazily hit by something that wasn't going to actually affect it for a long time. So, and we've seen a recovery in that, obviously, this last week. And I fully anticipate that will happen and will continue to happen. I suppose that my last question, even though the other one was my last question, is do you anticipate that there'll be more deals, even for the disposables in the short term?
Yeah, I think there will. I mean, all week, our independent store reps have been out selling product to new stores. They've been getting reorders as well. You know, the retailers aren't that worried about it because they know they've got a long, long runway and they don't want to chuck away revenue. So we're continuing to sell there. In terms of new deals with major retailers, yeah, we rolled out, ironically, to the first Morrison's stores on Monday. This hasn't come, you know, out of nowhere for them. This is not entirely unexpected. And so on that basis, you know, retailers will do whatever makes them money in a legal way. In this case, we know this is a hot category. We know these products do make them money. And so unless and until they are legally compelled to stop, they won't. So yeah, more deals, more work, and more sales.
I've got to say, Callum, I do like your cap. Can only be described beautiful red color. And at first glance, it looks like a MAGA cap, you know, Make America Great Again. But actually on further reading, it says Make AIM Great Again. So bit of sense of humor on that one. I do like it.
Well, we're not on AIM, but we've got to start making a noise and make AIM great again. So yeah.
Do you think that AIM will be made great again in 2024?
I hope so. I mean, I think that, you know, the UK market's had a pretty rough ride over the last 12 months. Not been many IPOs, not been as many deals as people would like. Raising money's been bloody difficult for a lot of companies. You know, the government will want to act on that. The markets will want to act on that. And by that, I mean the LSE and AIM themselves. So, you know, I know, Kev, you've got your own views on this. It's a question of, you know, what do they do to incentivize people? Do they force people to invest a percentage of their pensions in British companies? Whatever they do, they have to make it attractive to list in the UK again, because losing, you know, this financial centre would be, you know, a travesty. And I do think that this is a year where we'll start to see life come back into the markets. I hope that the government will respond in kind with whatever measure is needed to breathe life back into the UK listed sector.
Yeah, I mean, we have billions of pounds in pension money and we have billions of pounds in ISA money, and we're giving incentives for people to invest all over the world and not within the Great British Isles, if you like, which just is bizarre as far as I'm concerned. Especially as we've had nothing but disinvestment in terms of money going into UK businesses for a few decades, probably, if the truth be known. They have to change that. And even if it's a Labour government, I hope they really get wise and change it. If it's a Conservative government, I hope they get wise and change it, because it needs to change. We should be investing probably 50% of our money in UK companies. If you want the tax break, that's what you should do. That's what you should have to do. What would that do? It'd revitalize many, many companies, and many, many new businesses would consider being based in the United Kingdom because capital would be available, which is ultimately why they're called capital markets, Sean Corrigan. So yeah, again, thanks for your time.
Callum Sutton, CEO of Chill Brands. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, guys. Cheers.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to some of the movers and shakers this week. I think we talked, wax lyrical last week, about Helium One and the sort of meteoric rise. And that's done around about 100% again this week. We saw, I think we made a statement that potentially this was the first 10 bagger of the year, and it actually did go up 1,000%, didn't it? From January, from them announcing the discovery of the well results and hitting this.
It's end of day, no, but intraday, yes. Because I mean, basically on the Monday, I think it was, or possibly the Tuesday, I'm not sure which day it was. I think it probably was Tuesday, wasn't it? Because I had a great day on the Monday.
And it was like 2.3, 2.4p, didn't it?
Which... Yeah, I think 2.4p was paid, I think it was, on that morning.
Up of 80 million at that point.
Yeah, and then by the end of that day, it was down at 1.3 or 1.4.
It went to 80 million and to 37 million market cap on that same day. It was back there. Peak, so it was massive fluctuations, but
yes.
What I mean is it had moved 1,000% in, and it hit that point, but as you say, it finished the day probably around about the 600% up. So great performance on that one. What else have we got? We've had a really, really nice RNS from Power Metal Resources, which basically detailed them raising 1.2 million in a strategic funding round supported by UK high net worth individuals and a strategic Saudi Arabian investor. The funds will be used to accelerate exploration programs across a portfolio of mining assets with exposure to uranium, copper, lithium, gold, and graphite. The funds were raised at a premium to the prior day's closing. So really good to see a premium raise there, and also it going into effectively sticky hands, because ultimately this isn't just going to be churned out and flipped, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw the reaction in the market. There was buys in at 125, I think 1.25p after that news. I think towards the end of the week, it settled back at 1.05, 1.1, I think. But still a very good week, you know, 25% or thereabouts. There was also the Molocco Farms update, the nickel platinum play. I think what you get with POW is you've got, you know, underpinned by Golden Metal Resources. Obviously, they own 63% of Golden Metal Resources. You've got an IPO coming very shortly for UEE, which is going to be the uranium play. You've got the Molocco Farms. You've got any number of different projects. And now they look like they're going to scale into some deals and some exploration in Saudi Arabia. Obviously, with the part of this raise being involved with people in Saudi Arabia. So you've really got an all-round great play in Power Metal Resources, and the different spin-offs, I think, should also start to do well. I mean, I know for a fact that Charles Archer, who was on last week, massive fan of Power Metal Resources. The interesting thing is he wrote an article a number of months ago giving it a target price of just over 3p, I think it is. I think it's 3.2 or 3.3p. with all the different assets. And as I commented to him this week, that I expected that Golden Metal Resources would account for more than half of that if we achieve the tungsten grant, for instance, from the US government, and all the different stuff that's going on with the copper plays and stuff that they've found off. Yeah. So very, very interesting play. I mean, if you take 3.2p or 3.3p, there's potential upside there of a couple of 100% minimum with nothing else good happening. So yeah, extremely interesting. And also we saw news, I think, this week from Galileo. I, rather than wax lyrical about that, please tune into the Zambian special that we did with Colin Bird and a lawyer from Zambia who's involved in those projects. And that really refers to Galileo, African Pioneer, and Extract Resources, all of which have licenses in that part of the world in northwest Zambia. You know, you should take some time and have a listen to that because, you know, and there's not just those companies. You've got ARC Minerals up there as well. You've got Tertiary Minerals. You've got Jubilee Metals just as an overall play in Zambia in terms of copper production, which I believe is going to be a really big play over the next period of time. You know, all of this is around. I would imagine you're going to get news from quite a few players coming up next week with Ndaba coming up. You know, people are putting news out to talk about and to have the communication with other people in terms of deals and all the rest of it that might happen.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, the news you alluded to was initially, it was like on Tuesday there was an announcement from Galileo regarding three copper targets discovered in Botswana on the Kalahari Copper Belt. And then there was another announcement on Thursday, wasn't there, that basically said further to the announcement of the three copper targets, they're also pleased to announce two further new targets derived from a recent terra-leached soil geochemical survey on licenses PL39 and PL40 located towards the southeastern basin margin of the Kalahari Copper Belt. So five targets identified now on the Kalahari Copper Belt. So that all looks very good. But yeah, absolutely. It was really good to catch up with. It was Tolai Tikumba, wasn't it? She's the CEO of Cooper Lemon Consultancy, who are the company that Extract and Galileo have done the joint venture with on those northwest Zambian licenses, aren't they, that in Zambia there. So it's well worth listening to Tola. She speaks very well, doesn't she? She knows a lot about geology.
I think they're also part of the African Pioneer deal as well. I think she's had all of them.
Yeah.
Or they are in all of them, if you like, the company. But there is no smoke without fire. We've got all, if not all, of the majors in that area. You know, you've got Rio Tinto with ARC Minerals, I think it is. You've got First Quantum with African Pioneer. You've got, I think, is a BHP in one of the licenses as well. Effectively, and the news also, even that's Zambia, but the news even going down to Galileo news, I think, was basically that Cobra, an ASX company that's been listed, has also got a big project down there and has been granted a grant by the BHP grant situation as well, I think, in Botswana. So there is such optionality and potential in all of these. You know, we banged on about copper probably starting a couple of years ago. From a market perspective, we were probably too early, if the truth be known. But I don't believe we're too early now. I think, honestly, you know, it's setting itself up that
yes,
it's going to be a big deal.
I think Zambia, Botswana, you know, even Rwanda, places like that, we've seen it, basically an agreement, an exploration agreement between Rio Tinto and the Rwandan government, which you would have been unheard of many, many years ago. That was announced at the end of January. You've got all these companies. You've got the Chinese going into Botswana with MMG and going into this cuprous copper. You've got the likes of IRH, Abu Dhabi Investment, moving into Zambia to work with, you know, on the Mopani copper mine, which was a Zambian government-owned MCM. You've got so many majors now working in the area. And actually, when you look at the news about Panama and Chile that came out, where they're closing down the likes of First Quantum's assets and other major, you know, companies' assets, people are not going to want to deal with jurisdictions like South America, and if this is happening, are they? They're going to want to move all their assets into safer jurisdictions where they've got governments who are compliant and want to, you know, have a target of, say, 3 million tons of copper. So for me, Zambia, Botswana, all these areas now we're talking about, even Namibia, are just absolute gems of areas to do business.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be, you know, I'm pun intended, it's going to be the hot orange area, isn't it? You know, which is obviously the copper in those areas. And even it was very interesting, I don't know whether you got it as well, but very interested in listening to the sort of potential size of the copper assets in Morocco. Again, obviously in Africa, were really outstanding. You know, I mean, the type of mine you're talking about is, you know, 10 to 20,000 tons a year for 20 years. This is big money. This is $150 million of revenue a year from those situations. Yeah. And maybe half of that is profit, but I mean, even half is, you know, if you have a company with $75 million of profit a year, how much is it worth? How much is it worth?
On it, 5, 6, 7, 8, something, I don't know. I mean, how would you work it out? But I mean, if that's profit.
It could be, from a profit basis, I think, to say 10 wouldn't be over the top, especially if you've got a 20-year mine life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you'd be talking about $750 million, you know, just for one. Now, the reality is going to be joint venture. There's going to be costs involved to get the mine up and run it and all the rest of it. So let's not use 750 as a figure. But even a quarter of that, if a small company was left with a quarter of that in terms of valuation, what are you talking about? $175 million US dollars. So yeah, let's say £120 million, £150 million, you know, that type of range. You know, this would mean Ethereum would be worth like 15 times to 20 times what it's worth now, with nothing else, with forget about Rwanda, forget about Botswana, forget about any other asset in Morocco, forget about the trading arm. You know, that's what we're looking at. You know, in perspective, I think, you know, they've got such optionality with all the different assets, and one of them's going to come good, I'm sure of it. And if it does in any way, shape, or form, then I think that's the sort of valuation that you're looking at. So it's got to be well worth a look, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. First Class Metals had a good RNS out on Thursday. Sunbeam Property High Grade Gold Assay Results. I don't know if you saw that one. Obviously, the contains three sub-parallel mineralized structures, each identified over 10 kilometers traversing the property and inferred to continue to the northeast into the recently staked area where prospective structural features are inferred. First Lab Metal now commands a district-scale land package of over 70 square kilometers. So that looked very, very good, didn't it? On the end, the results of stripping and confirmed high-grade gold assays up to 18.8 grams per ton of gold over a 0.3-meter channel sample.
It did. And I mean, that share price now is a bit of an anomaly because basically there was a big seller who sold down from 6p and basically took 4p or just over 4p for the share price. So now it's an anomaly. Shouldn't be worth less after that news when it was already 6p. So, you know, there's an opportunity, I think, there sort of not a gap to be filled. But I mean, in my view, it was well worth 6p and now it's sitting at 4p simply because market mechanics and somebody sold out, which I think that slack's been taken up already, but it seems to be people have got nervous.
And then they also had some news on the Friday morning as well, where they announced encouraging results from Palladium One's exploration in the West Pickle Lake joint venture area. Notable findings included extensive conolith feeder dike structures spanning over 5 kilometres with hole TK23134 yielding 1.8% nickel and 1% copper over 1.5 metres with an additional new nickel zone with impressive intercepts including 1% nickel and 0.4% copper over 0.9 metres in hole TK23128. So that looked really good. Mark Sale obviously expressed his optimism and intends to pursue third-party interest in this North Hemlo sector. So all shaping up very, very good in Ontario, Canada for First Class Metals.
Yeah, and I saw Darren Hazelwood was popping up.
Yeah, saw him talking about how it translates to Panther, didn't he, which was good.
Yeah, so, you know, it does translate for sure. They have a whole district with nobody on the gate with them at the minute. So, yeah, and he's a character as our Darren. So, yeah, So it's good to see him out walking the dogs and talking to people about it. So, yeah. But it is very significant for Panther Metals. We own 100% of Dotted with no underlying financial instrument attached. It's good. And as we see that Ontario mining district sort of move up, you will see positives. And the other interesting thing is First Class Metals. Who owns a good part of First Class Metals?
Yeah, Power Metal Resources. No, wait a minute. So many in that area, Future Metals, First Class, Power Metals, it's like that.
So again, what we're saying is when we were coming back to Power Metals, it's got so many sort of irons in different fires that are undervalued for its total valuation at the minute, that the sum of those valuations, as Charles had said in his written thing, which is worth a read, by the way, is 3.2p, I think it is, or 3.3p. So there's definitely upside in that. And also, you are spreading your risk as well with Power Resources, and I think it's a good bet. Now, we obviously chose Golden Metal Resources ourselves as one of our stocks this year, and we did that simply because really the upside of that, in our view, is potentially much greater than Power Metal Resources. But then who knows? Who knows? Because Power Metal Resources has got a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah.
So we will see.
Good. So in terms of markets this week, FTSE looks relatively stable. Interest rates obviously on hold for, I think it's like the fourth consecutive months around the 5.25% mark. That follows the back of the US, obviously holding rates there steady as well. So let's see what happens on that one. It doesn't look like there's any sort of decrease on the horizon probably for the next 2 or 3 months, but probably into summer now before we start to see it steadily potentially come down. Obviously, we saw.
You say that, but one of the guys voted for on the board voted for an immediate reduction.
Yeah,
and two voted for an increase. So I don't know what planet they're, but I see the direction is definitely going to be downwards, and the next move will be down. I'm fairly confident of that. When will it happen? Who knows.
So just on to something a bit more lighthearted, just a bit of escapism. There's two things I watched on Netflix this week, well worth a watch. The first one, you probably remember the movie from 1993, it was Alive. That was based on the true events in 1972, where the Uruguayan college rugby team had suffered a misfortunate accident that the plane came down in the Andes. And basically, it's a remake of that movie, or a remake of the story that the book was based on. It's by director J.A. Bayona, and he mounts the infamous Andes plane crash on an epic scale and treats the living and the dead with the dignity that they deserve. It's in Spanish with English subtitles. It's a phenomenal, beautiful film. Obviously, very disturbing. You probably remember what happened from that movie Alive. You probably saw it, Kev, when it came out in the 90s. It made the movies. But yeah, I won't go too much detail about what they have to do to survive. I think they survived for some like 72 days in the snow. And yeah, phenomenal story of survival. So well worth a watch. And the other thing was a series. I think it's a three-part. It's called American Nightmare. But that was based on a harrowing home invasion and kidnapping in 2015, and the couple were accused of basically staging the ordeal, and it's sort of how it all pans out, and it becomes effectively like a real life Gone Girl, which is well worth watching. So that there's two recommendations for you on Netflix for you this week if you fancy something to do over the weekend. But on that note, I'll say cap a good time at Indaba, and I will see you in Namibia in a couple of weeks.
Indeed. We'll, I'm sure, be given some info from Indaba while I'm there.
Yeah.
And yeah, next Sunday we'll have, a recap of lots of things that have happened or are happening in Indaba. And anything else that happens in the market. So again, thank you for listening.
Cheers for listening. Hit the subscribe icon and also the bell icon for future notifications of any future episodes. So thanks for listening.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.